welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 248. I'm Vince Diamante, broadcasting not so live to you from good old Southern California. Not so sunny this time, but I imagine it's a fair sight better than what you're experiencing up there in Sweden. Isn't that right, Alex? How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thanks, Vince. It's wonderful to be with you again and with all of our listeners for the, what are we at, episode 248 of the Game Audio Hour. Actually, firstly, to answer your question, yes, it's very nice. Very, very good weather here today. It's been raining quite a bit, yes, quite good. But I was going to ask, are we not nearing actually our 10-year anniversary for the Game Audio Hour?
Yeah, I think that's about right. We broadcasted sometime in 2014. That last episode, Austin asked a question, and that made me look through the logs. And January of 2014 was when we did our inaugural episode. Some of the faces have changed, but it's still the Game Audio Hour. And I'm not sure what number that will be when we hit that date. But once we get there in January, I guess we should do something to celebrate, right?
Yeah. What do you have in mind? We'll have to have a discussion about that to see what kind of madness we can conjure up.
Come over to SoCal. Let's record something live.
That actually, could be an interesting idea. I might have to consider that. But anyway, how about that game audio? Let's rip into it. So we've got a number of sort of gearish topics to run through today. But before getting into that, I believe you've just completed your attendance at a certain game related event there, Vince.
Ah, yeah, I did. I've been having a lot of fun just trying to do some more fan events. For a long time, I would say, oh man, I don't need to go here. I don't need to enjoy myself. No, that's not true. I do. I actually like playing games. I like being part of video game culture. And just this past weekend was EVO, which is the big fighting game tournament that happens in Vegas.
Wow.
It's been 20 plus years of that tournament, and it's really surprising when I tell people that I had never been to EVO until last weekend, because I had been in the video game community for a long time, and specifically, I had been working on fighting games professionally for more than a decade, and yet right. I don't go to the premier fighting game event in North America. It's kind of crazy that I haven't been to EVO until last weekend. And honestly, I had a lot of fun. It was just 3 days of madness, a lot of focus on the big games. I mean, things like Street Fighter VI and Tekken 7 and Guilty Gear, Strive. And man, it was really fun actually just going around to the different areas where people are bringing their own consoles and playing some retro games, playing some Dragon Ball, playing some weird doujin games like Vanguard Princess. They had a whole section with, I think, nearly 100 cabinets, 100 arcade cabinets set to free play. And I had a lot of fun just hanging out there and playing really obscure fighting games like Fighters Impact A and Rumblefish and some new games that people are making, because people are actually still caring about making games for the arcade scene, even if that's not the big moneymaker that used to be 20 some years ago. But
that's cool,
man. It was really fun.
I have to ask a few did you see questions now. So did you see any Virtua Fighter? Any Virtua Fighter machines there?
Actually, no. No Virtua Fighter.
No Virtua Fighter. Oh, no. What about Last Bronx or Fighting Vipers?
Actually, there was Fighting Vipers there, yes.
Ah, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
But no Last Bronx?
No Last Bronx. Let's see. Yeah, there wasn't that much Sega love over there. It is kind of funny considering Virtual Fighter was the 3D fighter for a long time. And nowadays, I mean, that was a long time ago. Virtual Fighter 1 was 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? But they got up to, was it 4 or 5, I think? Virtual Fighter 4, I think, was Virtual the last Fighter one. And then
Virtual Fighter 5. Actually.
Five, sorry. Yeah, and then the characters sort of somehow transitioned into Dead or Alive 3, I think, because you can play the Virtua Fighter characters in Dead or Alive. I think it's Dead or Alive 3.
A couple of them. Wait a minute, Dead or Alive 3, or was it? Because Dead or Alive is on 6 now, I think.
Okay. Was it 3? Maybe not.
It's so hard to keep up. Dead or Alive is... I mean, that's a series that's been updated a little bit more recently than Virtua Fighter. But again, it really is interesting how the whole fighting game scene has really stratified in a different way. You know, Virtual Fighter 4, Virtual Fighter 5 were really big a little more than a decade ago. Dead or Alive 4 and 5 also really big about a decade ago. And you don't see some of the other things that used to be big. You know, Soul Calibur wasn't big in this. Like, they had Soul Calibur 2 as a little retro offering from 20 plus years ago. Despite the fact that Soul Calibur has been updated a little more recently. I think they're on 5 or 6 now. But the big players were there. Guilty Gear, Street Fighter.
Any King of Fighters?
There was some King of Fighters, yes.
Okay.
There was actually an SNK booth over there. So they had some fun showing off some of their old stuff as well as talking about their new wares. They made some announcements about some new games. A new Fatal Fury game is actually coming out soon. So that's kind of exciting.
You know, this is sort of a little bit of a segue into something that I was thinking about last week. I was playing on the Switch on Nintendo Online. I was playing Twinbee. That's right.
Twinbee's great.
Yeah.
The Konami shooter.
Yeah, that's right. And that sort of led me in a little bit of a rabbit hole, sort of thinking about what else is out there for shooters at the moment, for like shmups and bullet hell games. And so I sort of went through a number of different, as you would, YouTube videos sort of covering the best shmups of 2023 and that kind of stuff. And, looking through these videos and looking at what's going on. One thing that's really, really interesting about video games is the degree to which we are now at the age with video games where we are definitely, maybe excessively, very introspective with the way that we design games. We have these sort of pockets of gaming culture and lore. For example, the shoot 'em up, right? Mm-hmm. And the shoot 'em up gets divided into, smaller little subgenres such as bullet hell or shmup, which is quite funny, isn't it? Because a shmup is different from a shoot 'em up. A shoot 'em up is sort of like an umbrella term. Then you have bullet hell, which is one type, and then a shmup, which is another type. Then you've got horizontal scrolling ones and vertical scrolling ones. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's exactly the same with fighting games too, right? You know, it's been as a genre, it's sort of been established and then refined. Gradually, each one of these big players in the scene sort of adding something new to the lineage of this genre of video games. I say excessive because sometimes I do feel that it's a shame that when we're designing, for example, a fighting game, we only see what the other fighting games are doing and what is the right thing to do for a fighting game and what players would expect for fighting games. And it's hard often to sort of look outwards instead of looking inwards. And I think that there might be a bit of a parallel with music as well in games. You know, we have these ideas that, for example, like, you've been contracted to do the soundtrack of Baldur's Gate 4. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. What kind of music are you going to do? Well, I guess it's going to be sort of medieval with war drums and orchestras and stuff like that, right? It's because that's kind of what you expect from a fantasy role-playing game. And it's the same with fighting games. There's a certain flavor. There's certainly the same with bullet hell games. They all tend to have a similar kind of soundtrack. And fighting games there are certain kind of key things that you would probably be expected to hit if you're going to be making the soundtrack for a fighting game. But on this weekend when you were, I don't remember if it was actually this weekend, but when you were at Evo, could you hear much of the sound design going on in all of these the recent games? And was there anything that you thought, wow, that's a totally different approach?
Certainly in the arcade section, it was tough. Yeah, because hey, you had arcade cabinets. Just you know, sometimes it was just these relatively bare speakers. You know, when it comes to arcade cabinet design, you know, the sort of standard arcade audio design is that you have amplified sound actually coming straight off of the motherboard into speakers that are just going to pump down, sort of shooting down across the screen and then sort of bouncing at you. And you basically, you hear a vague idea of what what is going on there, hopefully. And if you're not so lucky, then the arcade cabinets to either side of you are going to be actually much louder and you're struggling to get any sense of what the actual sound design is.
Right.
That kind of was the case for me, especially since I tended to play some of these less popular games over there.
Right.
But right. I think people did care a lot about sound design these days with modern games. And actually, you know, Sony, the sponsor for Evo, they are actually the owners of Evo these days. It used to be a big fan-run event, and now Sony has taken over the whole thing.
Wow.
They make a big show of, we're going to give you all of this stuff for the competitors. You're going to be playing on these high-quality gaming monitors that they make, and also these high-quality headsets. So you go to every station, and they have these really nice in-zone headsets that actually sound quite good. I had an opportunity to try those in-zone headsets when I was at Bit Summit actually last month, showing off our wares. Those worked actually really nicely, and I think that modern games do care a lot about that. They want things to sound a little more clear, a little bit more hi-fi, since all of the big mainstream games these days, they're not arcade releases. They're console releases. And if there's an arcade release later down the line, sure. But they're not going in with that first idea of, we need to fight for dominance in the whole, in that original loudness war of the arcade. Right.
Do you think that sound design for fighting games has been strongly influenced by the fact that these games all began in the arcade setting? So, for example, you know, the classic fighting game punch sound, right? Or any kind of impact, you know, it sounds nothing like, if you listen to like a, you know, a boxer, it doesn't sound anything like that. There's often not that much transient. It's sort of like, it's got this weird sort of sustain to it. It's just kind of like a noisy, kind of, you know, like a some kind of big, long, compressed snare drum or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that has become sort of the classic impact sound in fighting games just because, you know, in these original contexts where these games would appear in noisy arcades, that was really the only way to actually give audio that people would really realistically be able to hear out of the cabinet in front of them. Do you think that the sound design choices and the sort of classic sounds that we've come to expect from fighting games has been strongly influenced by that hardware aspect?
I think it has, although nowadays I think it's more like a reaction to it where people are seeing all that stuff and they associate a negative connotation with that. It's all this sort of broadband noise that seems to be unnaturally long relative to the actual time spent on the impact visually. Like a lot of modern games do have a lot more nuance happening to them. But I sometimes wonder actually while playing the game if there's in fact too much nuance. So like here's an example of what I mean. You know those sounds are going to be there are different characters beating each other up on stage. You know, you could have like the big burly like pro wrestler type, the sort of let's say like sort of a like a, I don't know, a short, squat dwarf swinging an axe. And that, okay, that axe has to have a different sound than the sound of a punch. But right. Should a kick have this, have a different sound than a punch? Should right. an elbow have a different sound than a punch? Should there be differences based on the clothes that this character is wearing? You know, like a wrestling singlet versus like a whole lot of heavy clothing, like, you know, like one of those Chinese traveling monks trying to, you know, disperse right. justice over the countryside or something like that. And like, there's that part of my brain that thinks, yeah, there should be significant differences that are happening there between all of those, because visually they're really different. Narratively, they're really different and people care about characters. But right. in terms of the game, what's going on? You know, if one attack puts the enemy's hit point bar down by 5%, and another attack, which looks different, puts the enemy's HP bar down by 5%, why not make those sound basically the same? Because that's really what matters in a game context. So, like, those two halves of my brain like fighting against each other as I'm wandering around and looking at the landscape.
I've just got to put in a mention for the classic Virtua Fighter 2, when you've downed the other character and you're going to go and in Virtua Fighter, if you down the other character and you press up and kick, then they all the characters have some way to basically land an attack on a fallen opponent that's on the ground. And when you do that in Virtua Fighter, it's always the sound of a girder. Like somebody hitting like an anvil with a steel hammer, like a cling, like that. And when I think about it now, like, it's totally ridiculous that it sounds like that when you basically, you're just watching this character, which is a foot landing on top of a body, sounding like this anvil and hammer impact. But in a noisy arcade, you know, you really, really hear that sort of full frequency ding like that when you land those ground hits. And yeah, it's just funny how, it's just sound design. It's fun, isn't it, in video games? Because you can really get away with a lot of crazy stuff that just because humans are naturally biased towards what they see, it just means that, you know, it could be something totally unrealistic and completely infeasible. Implausible, I mean, not infeasible. Completely just ludicrous. An anvil and a steel hammer, ding, like that when you make contact. Yeah. And yet, because you see it like that, you know, they sort of connect together in your brain regardless. It's funny how we can play these kind of games with players just because humans are naturally biased towards what they see.
Yeah, it's true. But I really think that it's kind of amazing what people can do when it comes to reacting to sound, though. I think a lot of the best fighting game players actually rely a lot on sound in order to figure out what's going on. You know, part of it is that animation has actually changed a whole lot in the last decade, you know, not just going from 2D to 3D, but things like, oh God, visual effects all over the place. The nuance that's there when it comes to spacing and how animation blending works these days. And there's so much happening on screen. And sometimes the sound is actually the thing that you rely on rather than the animation in order to give you your cues as to what is the right move to make in a situation in a fighting game. So, you know, back in the day when I was working on Skullgirls, we did a lot of testing with different people when it came to how well do these things read. Like, right. how good does this animation read? Can right. people who are colorblind actually see what's going on through the clutter of visual effects and the animation with when they have one costume versus another color costume and all that? And through that, they actually instead rely on the sound effect in order to say things to the player. Hey, yeah, this move is going. This move has successfully confirmed. This move is hit, and now we're going to go through a 2-second progression of all this other stuff that you can do afterwards and whatnot. And it's kind of cool to see players that can actually play on a high level, relying mostly or even totally on sound. And actually, there was some news that came out of Evo this year where this player who goes by the name of Blind Warrior Sven, who has actually been blind since 6 years old because of cancer.
Right.
He actually not just went in the tournament, but actually made a decent showing for himself, actually progressing, winning his second match in the tournament. We always hear stories like this about blind players playing games and doing really well. I remember a few years back, there was talk about a person that played all of Pokemon Blue, I think, for Game Boy, and actually beat the game relying solely on audio cues. And here we go. Here's a guy that is not just a person flailing away, but actually playing at a high competitive level just based on the sound cues in Street Fighter VI. And, you know, as much as I think, oh, I wonder if there is too much nuance going on. I wonder if this is just going based on the sound landscape, if that's a little bit hard to parse. Well, obviously not for this person who is actually using both the design of the sound as well as the real-time audio mixing in order to give him the right cues in order to play at a high competitive level.
I mean, that is absolutely amazing. And like, man, you know, what can you say about that? The amount of dedication and perseverance and patience and just sort of tenacity required to firstly to play a video game for, you know, the fact that it's something that we definitely need to be much more cognizant of and much more aware of, and also proud of, you know, the work that we're doing. We need to take pride in the work that we're doing in designing the soundscape for games and setting up mixing and stuff. Wherever possible, include detail and nuance to the level to allow people who are visually impaired like that to enjoy our work. But yeah, just like the tenacity and the determination and just the grit that must be required to achieve on a reflex-based game like a fighting game, you know, a competitive level without being able to see anything and relying entirely on the sound, that's just astounding. I mean, what an incredible person.
Yeah, it is so cool. Yeah, like you said, those stories I think are really great, and it does remind me that I should be taking pride in my work. I think sometimes I do think, oh, what am I doing? Am I just making sound for this thing? Oh, I'm just there to embellish what's going on that's really clearly established visually. And yeah, sometimes that is, in fact, what you're being called to do. You know, maybe a producer or an artist is sort of relying on you to do that because, you know, they can't be bothered with it. You know, they don't have the audio acumen. But it's not only about that once it actually gets in the hands of the players and they can find joy in so many aspects of the work that you might not even be thinking about. And for this person, And he's not alone. There's plenty of people out there that are not as sighted as a lot of the world when it comes to their enjoyment of games. They find that joy in the sound. You know, Street Fighter has a lot of cool things happening because, yes, the characters have these costumes, these personalities, the strength and machismo that is presented in the game as they go through stories, as they fight against different characters. So much of that is actually in the sound. Some of it is really obvious in things like, oh, the performance by the voice actors. And some of it is a little less obvious, like, oh, the sound of that fireball sounds awesome. Or the sound of this particular special move traveling through the air feels powerful. Yeah, so I think it is really cool to have that, to be aware that there are people that really, really care about what's going on. I think after so many years of working on this, I personally need reminders of that, where, am I just working on this? Well, to someone else that's on the other end of this game that you're working on, it's not only that. It might, in fact, be everything.
It's really remarkable when you think about it, what we do in game audio, if I can say so. It's just, you know, there's a large majority of players who would never notice, you know, they would never notice the work that we put into making, you know, good sound mixes and good sound design and excellent appropriate music that embellishes emotion and all of this. You know, no, a large majority of players would just not notice. However, if you did it badly, then they notice. You know, like the sound design for this game sucks. But the fact that, you know, we can work in this sort of shadow realm behind the game itself, where we're actually tugging at strings of the emotions of the player without them even knowing, and making these associations with something that's visual and then something that's in sound that could potentially be completely ridiculous, but, you know, it makes sense to the player in that moment because they're seeing it and they're interacting with it. And to sort of be able to do all of this without the player really noticing at all what's going on, but just sort of feeling something and having the game feeling just fantastic, but they don't know why it feels fantastic, it just does. And, you know, the fact that we have direct control over that. And then, as you say, yeah, you know, I said that there's a large majority who don't notice the sound, but there's not to say that there aren't, you know, a huge number of people who are listening. And then as an extension of that, just as you said just now, like not only just listening, but also relying on the sound as well in some cases for cues and for timing and for obviously emotion. You know, it's a cool, compared to visual art, which is very much, well, I mean, it's literally what you see is what you get, you know, it's just right there. And it's very, in a way, it's sort of opaque, you know, it's just right there. You look at it, okay, I see what that is. Whereas with sound, we have this leeway where we can stretch things either side of what it actually physically would sound like, depending on the genre of the game and on the emotion and on it's what we're trying to communicate and what the game mechanics are. We have this sort of breadth of possibility that we can play with, which I think that makes sound design and music design for video games, I think it just generally makes it much more, I don't know, enjoyable and fun from a creative point of view compared to, say, visual art, where it's, you know, it has to look like something. Yeah, I mean, good job, us.
Yeah, we do some cool stuff, don't we?
Yeah. Coming back to the real world, you know,
Vegas is the real world too. Just I could live there for too long. 3 days was enough for me.
Isn't there supposed to be some saying that says what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas? Does that mean that you've broken some kind of cardinal rule about visiting Las Vegas now by talking about Evo?
No. I think, I mean, Vegas honestly is pretty fun, although I kind of miss the old days. So, I mean, there used to be a time when Vegas had a whole lot of arcade games. That's not really the case anymore. I mean, like, you know, the whole arcade game world has sort of died down, especially in America. That's why, you know, last month I was so happy to hang out in Japan, where game centers are still around. They're still a big part of a lot of metropolises over there. Even though they're also kind of on the downswing too. But
yeah,
hey, one whatever. Games are cool.
Yeah, just as a little coda there. One thing I never liked about the game centers in Japan is how you have these cabinets where you don't actually see the other player playing. They're on the other side. So you don't actually see them because they're, you know, you have the machine in between you and the other player and you don't see them. I remember in the good old days where you have these, you know, you shoulder to shoulder with the person right next to you, right? You know, this is a great way to get to know people and stuff. But Japan, yeah, arcade games are serious business. You don't go there and play an arcade game to meet people. No, not at all.
Well, I mean, kind of. You do kind of. But yeah, that is a little bit of a barrier.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. There's also a lot of those side by side styles of cabinet over there too. But It is interesting thinking about that whole Japan culture thing, but you know, we're not exactly the academic cultural anthropologists here. Although that's a world I wouldn't mind diving into, you know, maybe at another time. Another time.
Yeah.
Hey, I've been having a lot of fun lately. But what are you working on these days?
So I've been doing a lot of sound design work. Today I've just spent I spent the past 2 or 3 days doing some sound synthesis work. We have a part in the game that we're working on where you traverse through a kind of time warp tunnel, sort of like Doctor Who style, you know, where you've got like the sort of tunnel that you're sort of moving through to go from one dimension to another dimension. And I have to say that I'm doing all kinds of, I've been trying to do some like fancy fun tricks to be very, very specific. I want the sound to be kind of very warpish, you know, got to sound like, you know, warpish. Warpish. That's a good adjective, isn't it?
Warpish.
Warpish.
I don't think I've ever heard that, but I get what you mean.
I just made it up just now. But, for example, doing things like using flange effects and things like that. And like in this particular case, I'm using Wise's, for this warp sequence, we don't know how long it's going to be. So it has to be sort of dynamic to a certain extent. So the way that I'm doing it is I've created an RTPC in Wise, which I'm calling warp control, or maybe I should call it warpish control. And basically the programmers will just need to trigger the event and then take this RTPC from zero and increment it up to one gradually. Like as a sort of a linear progression from zero up to one as you traverse through this tunnel. So the idea is that at one, the tunnel is ending, and at zero, the tunnel has begun. Oh, sorry.
Ooh, okay.
That should be the other way around. Start at zero and end at one.
Gotcha.
So this value will sort of gradually be ramped up as you go through that sequence, which means that if they want to make this warp sequence like 3 seconds long, then you just make that value go from zero to one, ramp up 0 to 1 over 3 seconds, or if it's longer, then you just make it take a longer time. So this means that inside Wise, I have this useful RTPC that can be treated kind of like a timeline, and then I can just tie that into all kinds of stuff to create this sequence that can be dynamically adjustable in terms of its length. So, doing some fun stuff with Wise's internal real-time synthesis engine, I guess you'd call it, the tone generator, because of a lot of the values inside the tone generator can be obviously modulated by this RTPC, doing that to create a lot of nice effects that go over this span of time. I have to say, though, after 2.5 days of listening to a warp sound, you kind of go a bit crazy. What I'm doing is I'm doing a lot of stuff with intentionally using mid-side processing to boost the sides and reduce the mids in the bass frequencies.
Oh.
And yeah, when you do that in bass frequencies, it's a trick that we did in Space Folk City when we worked on that as well. You remember when we had the air quotes sound of space?
Yes.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to do there is to have this sort of out of phase sound in the bass region. And when you do that in the bass region, you get this kind of weird, almost a sense of pressure on your ears. It just sort of this, it's hard to describe it, but if you know what something sounds like when it's out of phase, it sounds like that. But in the bass frequencies, it gives you this weird warpish kind of, warpish kind of uncomfortable sort of pressure on your ears.
Right.
So yeah, that's what I've been listening to for the past 2.5 days, and I think I'm going a bit crazy. Yeah.
Don't go too crazy on that. I'm actually wondering when you were attacking this sound, were you thinking about it with that RTPC being an essential part of the sound right from the very beginning, or was that something that you just realized later on while designing?
No, that right from the outset, I knew that this has to be a sound that is dynamic. So I need some way to make it adjustable in its length. And being a sort of a warp sequence, you want it to start off and you want it to sort of have a sense of transition as you're moving through the tunnel, and then you want it to sort of gradually climax as you get to the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. So just because of the way that wires, you know, you can connect everything to RTPCs, it just made sense to have a number that the programmers could then, on a linear ramp, they could just ramp it up from 0 to 1 across the you know, the distance of this tunnel. And that way, mm-hmm. yeah. So it was right from the outset, that was my plan.
Yeah. And you already had a sense that it was going to be a few seconds, like 2 to 3 seconds as that longest time for it.
Yeah. So I asked the designer, and the designer basically said the longest would be about 7 seconds and the shortest would be about 3 seconds. But we don't know. And basically, because this is a VR game, and this kind of tunnel sequence with everything moving like that, and you're kind of going through this tunnel very, very quickly, is a definite no-no in terms of VR comfort. However, the director of the game really wants it, and he actually wants the player to have a brief sort of feeling of like, whoa, what's going on? Like actually intentionally making the player a little bit uncomfortable for a short amount of time, and which I guess from a VR comfort point of view, and at Moon Mode, you know, we are very stubbornly defensive of VR comfort, but yeah, this is a game that we're contracted to work on, and this is what they're asking for. So it's not our position to be objecting to this. Mm-hmm. Because of that, anyway, you know, that's the reason why when we've got the visual effects set up and the sound is all set up, we may try it at 7 seconds and realize, oh, whoa, that's like really too much, and it just like feels terrible. Then at least we have the means to easily shorten it down to 3 seconds without me having to go and reauthor the entire sound.
Mm-hmm, right. But I imagine also like in sound, that's easier to sort of do. And, you know, when you're talking about that out of phase, low frequency stuff happening in both sides, that makes sense that it could sort of add to that.
Yeah. I in the process of doing this, actually, so I've been doing a lot of audio rate modulation to create like a sort of a sci-fi sound, sort of a warp kind of sound. And I went through, so many of my soft synths to find one that does audio rate modulation in a nice, mm-hmm. nice clean way that you would want. And in the process of doing this, I discovered that actually my pitch bend on my Roland MIDI controller is actually broken. So,
oh, no.
Yeah, I think I might be in the market for a new controller very, very soon. And so I when I needed a little bit of break from all this warpishness, I did a little bit of window shopping, so to speak. And just sort of because I've been thinking about synths doing this modulation work, I was, having a look at whether, well, you know, maybe instead of getting a MIDI controller, maybe I should just get a synth. Like that could
Why
be
not?
Cool. So, I was having a look at some of the different. There's a lot out there now for like hardware synthesizers, and it goes far beyond the usual, you know, Roland and Yamaha and Korg and the usual players. There's a lot of new companies on the scene that are making like really excellent keyboard synthesizers now, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know if you intended that, but I've actually been diving into that world too, because I decided to buy a synth.
Oh boy, Vince. This is great. I'm so happy right now.
Oh gosh,
Am I allowed to guess? I'm allowed to guess what it is you got? Do you think I'll guess it?
Okay. Let me give you some hints.
Okay.
So it is like a nice little desktop synth, of which there are many out there. Okay. This one is kind of a hybrid-y type synth.
All right.
So, you know, it can do like, you know, it basically has a little bit of digital, but also analog on it. And you can do like some wavetable stuff in there too, and you can actually hook it up to your computer and have fun editing wavetables from there.
Okay, is it a Waldorf Blofeld?
It is not a Waldorf.
Is it made by a Japanese company?
It is. Oh, no, it's not made by a Japanese company.
Okay. All right. In that case, I might be... Is it a sequential?
Yeah, you're getting warm.
Okay.
It is a sequential.
Okay.
That I think that actually helps to narrow that down a lot.
Okay. You just go ahead and tell us now. I'm not super familiar with the...
Yeah, it's the Pro 3.
Pro 3,
okay. I've got a sequential Pro 3 on my hands right now.
Amazing. How is it?
Well, honestly, I've played around with it for exactly 20 minutes. And I haven't actually touched it since because I am currently working on some music, but this soundtrack that I'm currently working on is purely acoustic.
Oh, so
I'm
okay.
Like, oh, God damn it. I can't use this right now.
Well, Vince, I'd be happy to take that off your hands and give it a good home.
Oh, man. I think it has a really nice home here, although I do want to get another stand for it because right now I just have it on the floor and then I'll pop it onto my desk as needed.
Okay.
But I haven't had to use it. I need to get this one track out of me, and I am so stuck on this. It's so stupid, but I am kind of doing a little, the last 2 days, it's been solid writer's block for me. And now not even thinking about it and just doing stuff in order to get past this track because I'm tired of this track.
Yeah, maybe this could be a good, I mean, obviously it's not going to be useful for the track if it's an acoustic track, but spending this time to just have a bit of a fiddle around and a deep dive into your sequential could be just the break that your subconscious mind needs to, you know, come up with some new ideas for this track, perhaps.
Maybe. I feel like, well, let's see. Right now I am making progress because usually when I am totally writer's blocked like this, like, okay, one day of writer's block is one thing. 2 days... Okay, I need to take some drastic measures. So what I'm doing right now is I'm just writing some tone rows and thinking I'm just going to, you know, do these tone rows, cut and paste effectively in various places and think about the music in the abstract instead of thinking, oh, does this sound good? Because, you know, I've got a couple of basic sort of modern compositional formulas that I'll do in order to just make things work. Because that's all I need to do for this track. I need this track to just work.
Mm.
And then once I get to that point, then I can move on. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm not sure about... now that I say that, maybe that's what I should be doing on this synth in order to play around. It might be fun sort of messing around with like a little bit of that matrix sequencer that's on there from this perspective of because, you know, tone rows and synthesizers, that's actually a pretty good combination there. Haven't really thought about that.
Yeah, it is. It's tough, isn't it? You know, when, especially, how long is this cue that you're working on? Is it a longer one?
Not too long. It's like 2 minutes.
Okay, right. Yeah, I definitely feel, I think, well, everybody listening who's done music for a video game is probably feeling your agony there. The sort of, I often equate, writing music is often, I feel like it's like pushing a big boulder up and over a hill, right? You know, the uphill part of this climb is just agony. When you're sort of trying to push it up, you're trying to find the sound, or you're trying to find the direction for the song, and you don't really know. It's kind of, this is the same kind of thing that I always do. Maybe I should be doing something different. I don't know. It's just not sounding good. And that at some point, you reach the top of the hill, and then the boulder starts rolling on its own momentum, right? And then at that point, you're sort of running to keep up with it. And it's really, it's one of the the most joyous parts of writing music, I find, is when the music starts to speak to you, right? And it's telling you what it has to do next. And you just listen to it and you hear, oh, obviously it's got to do this next. You know, it's really, the music is speaking to you now. And that the joy that you feel in that moment, that the magnitude of that joy is only matched by the magnitude of the agony that you feel in getting to that point. However, what I've noticed is that, like, especially for longer cues, even though it can be really joyous sort of chasing your song as it's sort of heading in a direction on its own steam and you're just running behind it trying to keep up and trying to put things down as fast as you can, if you have to do that for too long, then it can also, it's like you go over one mountain and it starts rolling down the other side and then it comes down to the bottom of valley and then now it's sort of going up another mountain and you're just sort of trying to push it up that one instead. It's like this constant sort of passage of, you know, peaks and troughs and sort of going up to the peak and then going down into the trough and then up and down. And yeah, certainly this project that we're working on, each one of the cues that I have to do is 10 minutes long. They need to be about 10 minutes long.
Oh, that's within, very long. Wow.
Yeah. Within that 10 minutes, you've got 4 to 5 looping sections. So you need to, it needs to be such that, you know, in the first section, it can loop, but the second section can start at any time within the first section's loop. And the same goes for the third section. Anytime it can be triggered, anytime from within the second section's loop, and the same for the fourth and for the fifth. But it also has to be listenable as one long 10-minute piece of music. And that's what we were talking about last episode with Austin, where, you know, in this particular case, I'm considering the soundtrack even before we even have a soundtrack. I'm considering the soundtrack release. And I'm basically writing a 10-minute song that can be listened to as a 10-minute song, but each one of these sections can be sort of interchanged and can be triggered at any point. But when it's that long, you know, that's the point where you have multiple sort of ups and downs and ups and downs, and it can become really, really, really exhausting.
Yeah, I feel like it's less like trying to follow the whims of that metaphorical boulder that's just rolling up and down, and perhaps more like trying to establish a supply line for that path that you've taken. It's like, wait, does this all work, really? You're looking back and it's like, oh, you're actually reflecting on that even.
Right. I think I'm always envious of the work that you and Mike do, because I think I always feel that the genres that you can work in, especially when you're dealing with acoustic textures or an orchestral sound, this is entirely from the point of view of an amateur, because I don't do orchestral stuff. I just usually contract you or Mike to do it if I have need for that. But I always feel a bit envious of people who work in that realm, because it feels like you have less stringent, strict sort of genre limitations. Unlike electronic music, which is the realm that I work in, you know, for example, with this soundtrack for this game, it specifically has to be sort of heavy synth wave, or I guess dark wave, you might call it. With some influence from metal. And so the constraints to get sort of something that sounds like dark wave or that sounds like heavy metal, there's sort of certain sound and sort of timbral constraints that you must adhere to get it to fit that mold. And so when you're writing a 10-minute piece of music in this genre, not repeating yourself is really hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, over the span of a 10-minute track like that, it can get really, really exhausting. But, yeah, I think if I had a Sequential Pro 3 next to me, I think I'd be very, very easily distracted, I think.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Have you ever played any of the so-called, you know, the big flagship sort of workstation style synths from the Japanese makers? Like, I'm thinking of the Montage or the Roland Phantom series. Have you ever tried any of them?
You know, gosh, you know, one thing that I've always done is that I've always, one, enjoyed playing them. Especially the Roland Phantoms. I've always liked those. They have, I feel like they just have a really fantastic sound and really fantastic playability. They're like, just the controllers on those things actually feel really nice. Right. But also I immediately dismiss it because those things are big. You know, I have a particular desktop, and actually right now I have a big old tape measure that's next to me because I always look at these things online and I think if I put this thing on my desk and I want it to be right in front of me, will I still have space for my keyboard and mouse? Like, I just don't. And it makes me think, oh, maybe I should just get a bigger desk. But kind of seriously, yesterday, I was looking at this listing for a Roland Phantom 6.
Right.
And, you know, they have their Phantom, which is their flagship synthesizer, keyboard, workstation type thing. And I should go for it because this thing is actually on a huge sale right now. Like, right, usually this thing goes for about $3,000, you know, plus tax and shipping and all that. And I found a place, Woot, that is currently selling it for $2,100, which is a huge savings. It's insane. But then I looked at the specs and I think, how much more deep is it than my current 88 keyboard, 88 key controller?
Right.
And I'm thinking, is my keyboard going to fit? No. Well, what if I get like a separate keyboard attachment just for my keyboard and mouse, and then I step back or move my seat a little bit further from my monitor? Maybe. I don't know. Like, I've gotten to this weird point where I really do think that the ergonomics of me working, I'm valuing that so much more than all of these other things that I know this thing provides, because I know I love Roland sounds. I know that this thing would provide redundancy or maybe just totally replace like the Roland Romplers that I actually currently rely on for certain stuff. So it's not a, you know, that's not a bad acquisition from that standpoint, but ergonomics, I'm just not sure how exactly this will fit.
My concern is, like, I'm also, as you know, I'm a huge, huge Roland fanboy, as you know. And my concern is just how it would fit into to a workflow. So I subscribe to Roland Cloud, and I use Roland Cloud stuff fairly frequently for that kind of sort of bread and butter stuff. And for example, something like the Phantom, any one of the Phantom keyboards, my biggest concern would just be like, would I actually use it? So for example, the modules that I have, like I have a JV1080 and the D110 and an MKS50. These are all Roland rack modules from the 90s. And in Cubase, all I need to do is just turn them on, and in Cubase, it's all set up like you use hardware synthesizers in Cubase much like a VST. It's great. Yep. It comes up together in your list of other software synthesizers. It's your hardware synthesizer, and you just click on it. It does everything. It all sets it all up, and then you can actually, just from your screen with your mouse, you can actually go through the presets on the track inside Cubase, and you don't even have to touch the hardware at all. So you get all the benefits of the hardware synth in terms of sound, character, and things like that, with the convenience of a software, like the convenience of a VSC. It's fantastic. I previously also had, do you know the Dopfer Dark Energy series?
Oh, yeah. I know that one.
Yeah, Yeah, you previously had a Dope for Dark Energy 2, and that is sort of one of these. They're very, very popular these days, this kind of desktop analog synthesizers. I mean, the Sequential Pro 3 is one of these as well, but the Dope for Dark Energy 2 is like a small single oscillator analog synthesizer. And the problem was really that I got it because I was thinking, this would be great. It's convenient. It just sits on the table. And when I want to use it, I can just, plug it into the interface and it can be connected to MIDI and I can just pull up a track and then start twiddling some knobs and recording the output. But I never really actually used it that much. And I always just found like the full recall of the semi modular synthesizers that I use in software, primarily my most loved and most well used software synthesizer is Bazil from Yuhi.
Right.
Just the convenience of having everything on the screen there and being able to just recall patches and presets and stuff like that, and then of course modulate stuff from within the DAW, just meant that I never really used the Dark Energy. So ultimately, I ended up selling it. So that's why I'm thinking that if I got a synthesizer like the Phantom, would it give me enough benefit in being something on the table in front of me when I already have Roland Cloud and I already have a JV-1080 that's easily accessible from Cubase? So, yeah, I don't know. I'd be kind of nervous about it for me personally.
Yeah, that's really tough. I mean, I've definitely thought about those desktop modules as well. And I think I had a similar thing where it looks cute. It looks like it can just sit alongside anything. But sitting alongside all that stuff means that maybe you'd rather just ignore it.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, I hope that what you haven't been ignoring this week is some conspicuous consumption there, Vince. I hope you've been diligently consuming things conspicuously. Has there been any games or books or movies or music or literature? That's books, I guess. Art galleries, architecture. Let's see.
Not too much. I have been, in terms of non-audio stuff, the only thing that I've been doing is catching up on some manga that I've been reading, actually.
Cool.
So I've been reading this series, which I think is just a really quite beautiful series. It's very well written as well as very well drawn, and it just totally takes me into like a really beautiful other world, and it's called Witch Hat Atelier.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever mentioned it on the show, but I've actually gone on and off into the series, and I actually recently got my wife Val into it, and it's just beautiful. Manga can really go all over the place. There are some manga that are really quite famous for being successful despite how absolutely crappy the art is actually rendered. Things like One Punch Man goes into that category, yeah. Or Attack on Titan. This is totally on the exact other side. It's absolutely beautiful.
Cool.
And the story is very elegantly told. I don't think it is the most unique story out there, but it is elegant. The characters are presented in a very elegant way, and the drawing, the design of everything is just exceedingly beautiful and detailed in a way that if you're not familiar with the breadth that's out there in manga, this is really surprising just how beautifully rendered everything is. So that's kind of the thing that I got back into. It's been running for a few years now, and the English releases sort of trail the Japanese by a bit, but it's really nice to dive back in there. I'm glad that I had that to actually while away the time when I wasn't actually at Evo, because even though I was in Vegas, I had to actually step back because on Saturday I played too many video games and my tendonitis was flaring up in my right hand.
Ooh,
so I decided to just retreat to my hotel room and actually read some manga on my Kindle.
Okay.
And, it was actually kind of a nice time that. So that's how that happened.
Cool. Sounds like a healthy respite.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. You can't play video games for 48 hours straight. 24 hours straight? Okay. 48 hours, that's a little bit much.
Right.
How about you, Alex? Have you been checking out anything lately?
Yeah, I'm a little bit late to the party. In fact, I'm very late to the party, but I'm actually playing Mirror's Edge at the moment. I'd never played it before. I'd always been intrigued by the art. And Mirror's Edge Catalyst was on sale. So I bought that, and then I thought, well, I might as well buy Mirror's Edge as well to play the first one. And so I was, as diligently as you do, I started on Mirror's Edge 1. I didn't actually last too long before I got a little bit frustrated at the controls. Like, I just couldn't, they weren't clicking for me. Like, something about it, like, one of the tricky things with because it's a parkour game where you're, like, you know, jumping off stuff and things like that, and being a first person perspective, it's very difficult to sort of sense when you're on the edge of, you know, a ledge that you're going to be jumping off, if you're going to be running towards it. You know, you don't you'd have to be looking down in order to see when the character is right on the edge. And just sort of a few too many moments where it was just like, oh, I fell off the edge because I didn't jump in time. Well, great, you know. So I'll just give Mirror's Edge a rest and I'll try Mirror's Edge Catalyst. And it was much better. It was much more, it's a much more modern game, obviously. I guess amongst Mirror's Edge fans, Mirror's Edge Catalyst is not as popular because it sort of, I guess it maybe modernizes things a little bit too much, where the fans of the franchise like it to be, you know, more purist, like the original Mirror's Edge, and Mirror's Edge Catalyst is much more of a kind of standard open world kind of game, whereas Mirror's Edge Catalyst, the original Mirror's Edge, is a bit more focused and streamlined, just simply by the nature of the hardware and the limitations on it from when it was released. Because I think it was like 2007 or something like that, Mirror's Edge, the first one.
Came out a while ago. I remember playing it a little bit on the Xbox 360. Right. And I thought, this is interesting. But I think, like you, it felt a little bit off to me, you know, because it is presented in that first-person perspective, but it didn't control quite like any other first-person game that I had played. So I guess I shelved it and I never got back to it. But that's kind of cool hearing that Catalyst is actually doing it for you.
Yeah, it's you can see that the focus in the sort of design of Mirror's Edge Catalyst really has been, okay, we want it to feel seamless. You know, you need to flow through the environment. Like, you know, when you see really, really talented parkour people, they sort of have this way of sort of flowing through the urban landscape. And that's the way that they really wanted Catalyst to feel. And it really does feel like that. Like, the controls feel much more, I don't know, you just don't think about them as much as you do in Mirror's Edge. You just sort of, you basically just sort of flow through the environment. And
that's cool.
The sound design, I have actually not, I mean, I've only played about an hour of Mirror's Edge Catalyst so far. The music's very good. That much I've noticed. And the rest of the sound design, I haven't really had a chance to properly concentrate on because I'm still sort of trying to learn how to play the game. So far so good. So late to the party, but very happy now that I'm here.
That's cool. I think I should probably check that out myself because, maybe that will change how I feel about Mirror's Edge overall. So cool. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
I guess on that note, we should call this an episode. So this was episode 248 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on X, I guess, at Game Audio Hour, where we post notices about episodes as they drop, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the social media landscape. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said in the last minute is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I try to write this Tone Row battle theme. Bye.
You said, I'm glad you said social media landscape instead of X-verse, because you normally say Twitterverse.
X-verse just doesn't sound quite right to me yet. I don't know, maybe we'll change in a few weeks, a few months, whatever.